Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I am always adventuring around the country when I'm filming or giving talks or lectures, and I find myself in wonderfully fortunate positions, being invited to places that excite me greatly. And I had a particularly fortuitous meeting yesterday with the team from Birkenhead Priory, who said, "Would you like to come down and see it? It's closed, it's the winter, nobody's supposed to be in there, but we can unlock it for you." So here I am. It's a cold day in the north, and I'm joined by Colin. Tell me about your position here.
Hi, I'm Colin Simpson. I'm Principal Museums Officer for Wirral. So I'm responsible for the Williamson Art Gallery in Birkenhead and Birkenhead Priory. The Priory has been... It's been a council responsibility since the 1890s, when it was bought by public subscription from the Lord of the Manor at the time, and restoration work was done at that time, and then it was handed over. And it's had mixed fortunes. It's now a scheduled monument. But there was a time when, I think as people used to say in the 50s, they used to come and they could collect the key from the Williamson Art Gallery, come down, let themselves in.
Oh, yes. There's still glorious places like that around the UK, where you get a key on a box that you can take.
That's right.
So it was like that till so recently.
It was that until the 70s, yes.
Gosh.
When it was made a scheduled monument, I think. But over the last few years, there's been a lot of money spent in terms of restoring the fabric and redoing displays and things like that. So it's a much more friendly and interesting place to visit now than it was in those days, where it was just a load of old stones, really.
And the thing that really excites me about this place, we are standing now inside the Undercroft, but what you've got here is, apart from the church, which we can talk about, met its a tragic fate. You've got the outlines of a beautiful 12th century monastic complex.
It dates from around about 1150. We haven't got exact dates, but it was around about 1150. And it was founded by Hemo de Massey, who was one of the sort of third generation Norman knight. That came over from William the Conqueror. And the Massey family seat was at Altrincham, where Dunham Massey is, National Trust House. But they owned extensive lands in Wirral. And there's only one place, Sorgle Massey is a village just by just outside Wallasey, that still carries the Massey name, but that's the last remaining bit of it, if you like.
And for our international listeners, we are talking northeast England, but northwest. Goodness me,
Birkenhead is on the side of the River Mersey, opposite Liverpool.
Brilliant, and this is a really important location historically. I mean, I get excited about the Wirral Vikings because, of course, this is a notorious area for that. But this is a place that's always reached out. It's reached out towards Ireland in particular. Got very close connections with those sorts of Celtic territories. And it's a strategically important location, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But Birkenhead, in particular, didn't develop as a town until the 19th century. It was a minor settlement. But it was always a passing place, because this is the point where the River Mersey narrows down to about a mile. As soon as you go upstream, it widens out and doesn't narrow until Runcorn, where it's the nearest bridge to the sea, the River Mersey. So I think from time immemorial, there would have been a passing place here.
Yeah.
Which gradually became formalised into a ferry. And eventually the ferry was actually operated by Birkenhead Priory.
Well, this is it. So this excites me, you see, because I love all things monastic. And this idea that the monasteries were, they're not just places with quiet monks praying and sniffing herbs. It was these are industrious hotbeds of activity and industry. And also very economically savvy places, aren't they? Because they're charging a toll, they're controlling this passageway.
Absolutely, yes. But I think that the Benedictines, this was a Benedictine house, probably built as an offshoot from Chester, which was the only other Benedictine house in this area.
Oh, really? Okay,
Which predated this. And so it was set up where we imagined that it was already, say, a passing place. And the Benedictines liked to be useful.
Yep.
They didn't ferret themselves away in the hills and pray and live off the fat of the land. And so they were ministering to people. But you reached a point, say, from 1150, it was only quite a small house. Mm. In 1318, they applied to the king, Edward the Second, to build a lodging house which was separate from the monastery grounds, so they could actually charge. Because if people were getting hospitality in the monastery, they were reliant on donations.
Right.
And it was running them into pauperhood, basically.
So that's the building that's over to the
a separate building that would have been over the road.
Okay. Because what you've also got within the complex here, because, again, one of the exciting things about Birkenhead Priory is how intact the cloister area feels, because you've got... We're in the Undercroft, which would have been beneath the refectory.
Yes.
And then on the other side of the what would have been the original cloister are lodgings, but lodgings for people who will be crossing. Is that
well, that's right, yes. There's the abbot's lodgings at one end, but there's what would have been a guest hall that went up a sort of a full height building, so 20, 30 feet. Mm. And that was a guest hall, so that was in effect the ferry waiting room. until the lodging house was built over the road where they could actually charge for food and lodgings.
I love this idea of kind of the travelling waiting room for visitors.
Well, if the tide was bad or the weather was bad, people could be here for a couple of days.
Of course.
You know.
And then also, as you said, taking the hospitality of the monks who are relying on donations. So,
that's right.
So,
yes,
it had to kind of upgrade and change its way of doing it.
I mean, they had a reasonably extensive portion of land in Birkenhead and other bits and bobs. They were allowed to take a portion of the fish that was caught off the river. They had tenant farmers and their own farm and all the rest of it. And from when Liverpool was developing as a town, because it only got its charter in 1207, they had a building in Liverpool that they sold stuff at the market in Liverpool.
Okay.
So they were commercially oriented. But 1318, they applied for the lodging house. And then 1330, they applied for the charter to operate the ferry, because you get the impression that there were shyster ferrymen who would charge what took their fancy.
Yeah.
And by taking over the ferry, it became regulated, and the fee became sort of set in stone, if you like.
But that's not till 1330. So, but what's exciting about this building from an art historical point of view for me is the architecture. The space that we're in at the moment, this Undercroft, is staggering, actually. It's beautiful. I love these are very early examples of sort of ribbed vaults, aren't they? Because what date is this space?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I can answer that off the top of my head. But I think this was in the second phase of development. So we're looking at 13th century.
That seems, yes, because the fact that obviously it's beautiful, this use of columns in the centre and then the way that they spring out.
Yes.
The sprung rib vault is certainly a sort of 13th, 14th century evolution, isn't it? With the points as well. So it's sort of borderline Gothic, borderline between
that's
the Romanesque and the Gothic. But all across the site, there's Lots of different architectural
elements.
Well,
there is, because the chapter house, which is the oldest part of the site, dates back pretty much to its foundation.
Amazing.
So that has a beautiful Romanesque door and windows either side, and then Romanesque vaults inside. And there's one round-headed window still in there. The other windows have been replaced in the probably the late 14th century, 15th century, with sort of Gothic ones, which have later stained glass in them.
And that's, I mean, this is so exciting for me to be with the chapter house, to be able to stand in a space that is Romanesque, that is coming so quick on the heels of the Norman conquest. This architecture of invasion in many ways, isn't it? Because it goes up quick, it's solid, it's permanent, it's stone, but it's quite simple too, isn't it? So in the chapter house, as you say, there's the rounded arches, which I suppose is one of the most characteristic elements of Romanesque. But again, on this site, that has evolved into this space that we're in, the 14th century section.
Yeah.
And then, beautifully, you've got the story carrying on to the Victorian era, haven't you?
Well, that's right, because on the same site, obviously, the site was closed by Henry VIII in the 1530s.
Was it part of the second stage or first stage?
No, it was the first stage, because it was very small. So 1536, it was closed down. And probably fairly soon afterwards, the church had gone, or the church of the stone was built, used for building, or walls, or roads, or whatever. The earliest view we have of the priory is sort of 1640s, where there are three arches still standing from the church, but that's all. And that's the same 1727, the book engraving. But by the end of the 18th century, those arches have gone.
Really?
But the rest of the buildings are pretty much as they were then.
Do we know what happened to the stone from the church, or was it simply lost?
No, it just disappeared.
Pillaged.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned earlier as well to me when we were talking outside, we're right on the river here. I mean, it's an extraordinary mashup of old and new, because you've got this incredible kind of nugget of medieval history, and then huge industrial cranes, massive ships. What's going on the river out there, and how's it changed?
Well, we have, as the town of Birkenhead developed, the first parish church for the town was built on this site, because it was already viewed as a consecrated site, if you like.
Okay.
But the town of Birkenhead didn't really start growing until the 1820s, when the opportunities to develop on the side of the river opposite Liverpool became available, if you like. Liverpool was growing, and there was this vast tract of empty space on the other side of the river, so why wouldn't you develop it? And the main catalyst for that was William Laird, who was a Scottish engineer, who started boiler works that became the shipworks, that became Laird. Laird Brothers became Camel Laird. They started off on Wallasey Pool, which is where the docks are now, and then in the 1850s they moved round onto the riverfront, directly between the priory and the river, looking straight over to Liverpool, and then they expanded south. And so what we have overhanging Birkenhead Priory are these massive cranes, because the biggest dry dock in the west coast of England, which is over that stone wall there, took away half the remains of the medieval church.
Well, this is
it. It was built in the 1950s.
So that was right up until, so was it the 1950s when that cut was made?
Yes.
God, I mean, obviously as a medievalist, I sort of spin, but the idea, because they cut right through what would have been the remains of the church. And just to think what the layers of archaeology and the things would have been that were lost into, so they were just cut into the docks.
Cut into the stone, because we're standing here in the Undercroft on a walkway, but you can see 6 inches below our feet is stone. So that's the sort of the bedrock of Birkenhead, if you like. And so, yes, it cuts straight down into the stone to create that dry dock. But in the late 1950s, the only thing that they were interested in was employment, was Harold Wilson's phrase, the white heat of technology. And that was the priority, and nobody would have imagined that somebody might want to come to Birkenhead for tourism or for heritage or for history. Not considered important.
Amazing, amazing. But again, you know, that's part of the evolution of the story of this place, isn't it?
Absolutely,
that this is a place that has continued to change, be relevant. Interestingly, even when we were starting to film, to record today, I was having problems with my microphone, because there's naval there might be some sort of a block on the on this area because there's naval vessels out there for
absolutely
military
that's
activity.
Right because I mean Camel Laird as a shipbuilder closed in 1993 and it's had various resurrections, but it's working actively as a ship repair yard and as a shipbuilder now,
building ships like Boaty McBoat Face.
Absolutely, that's right, which is going to be called the Sir David Attenborough.
Excellent.
But that's due to be launched first this year and then commissioned next year. Mm. And that is within 400 yards of where we're standing.
Yeah. Amazing. And I like this because, again, I think it keeps the story going. So you, obviously there was probably a crossing that goes back to ancient times out there. But then this idea that the Benedictines established themselves here, built their monastery over 400 odd years, it then goes into the hands of the nobility, and then the story goes on. It remains a parish church into the Victorian period, but then there's this industry and technology going on outside.
Well, that's right, yes. And even when the parish church was closed and demolished, the chapter house became a Church of England church again. So it's still used for weddings, funerals, christenings, and services. And so the life of the site carries on.
Yeah.
And we refer to, we say it's the small site, it's a small site with a big history.
Yeah.
Because in effect the whole history of the town is encapsulated within this site, even though you're standing within an industrial estate on almost all sides.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh, Colin, it's been amazing to talk to you. Now, listen, I also want to talk to your colleague who is here, Kate. Hi, Kate. Come on in. You've been listening patiently while I've been chatting away. Introduce yourself.
I'm Kate White. I'm basically a volunteer researcher for Birkenhead Priory and the Williamson Gallery. So what I do is mainly small interpretations to help put the Priory into its historical context so that visitors can get a sense of where it fits in to history. Because if you say 1150 to someone, they might not have the faintest idea of what was going on then. So I'm trying to sort of inform on that a little bit.
Yeah, and we're standing in an example of your work here, aren't we? So you came up with this section over here about medieval
I was medicine. Our volunteer coordinator suggested the idea for medieval medicine. So I just went away and researched this and produced a few panels on it. Being a monastery, it might have had an infirmary. We can't be certain if this one did because it was a small place. There's only about 16 monks here at most at one time. But Norton Priory, which isn't that far away in Runcorn, that would have had one. So it's just about how they would have treated people, the herbs they would have used, and methods and that.
Which, because again, you're a budding medievalist.
I am.
And you're slightly in love with all this stuff like me.
Yeah.
What is it that draws you to the medieval?
I don't know. I've just always liked it. My mother's interested in the same period, so it was just always on. Watching Cadfael when I was little. He's a Benedictine as well, always been the kind of thing. But yeah, just always been fascinated by it.
And the Benedictines are a fascinating order anyway, aren't they? I mean, there's this evolution of monasticism, as you were saying as well, Colin, this idea of the desert monks going off into the desert to be alone. Mm. What the Benedictines said was actually their God's army bring together and order and regulate the day. Yeah. Because there's a lot of order in the Benedictine day, isn't there?
Yeah, there was. We've got things upstairs with the clock about what they would do during the day. And there's prayers, I think, 8 times a day, something like that. And between them, they would be working most of the time, up at dawn sort of thing. So they were always busy and they probably would have had farmland.
Things to till.
Fishing probably as well. And like Colin mentioned, the ferry, they would be monitoring that.
And of course fishing, because they would have had an amazing supply. Yeah. But also, I know that the scriptorium here isn't contemporary, but there possibly was a scriptorium here with the monks writing and producing manuscripts.
We would assume so, yeah. We can't, like Colin said earlier as well, that we couldn't think of any other papers for what it would be. And because that was, like, they were the only people that sort of produced manuscripts or books at that time.
Yeah. Tell me a bit more about the abbot that founded it and how it came into being.
It was founded by Hemer de Massey, who was a Norman knight.
Right.
I think the foundation at that date, round about 1150, he was actually quite young, but it was just before he was going to go on the Third Crusade, possibly around about that time.
It's all about that time of crusade, but also this funny overlap between the spiritual and the secular world.
Well, that's right. But you know, I mean, it was always sold to me at A-level history that they were buying their way into heaven, basically.
That was
the basis of it. And so as a young teenager, he made this creation and then went off to the Crusades. And he lived into his 80s, so it obviously worked for him,
you see.
So what you're doing in the foundation is that you're, in effect, paying for this crew of monks there to pray for your soul and the soul of your descendants. To make your passage into the other world a little more smooth, shall we say.
But it would have been quite... I mean, the thing I like about thinking about monasteries, early medieval monasteries, is thinking quite how luxurious they would have been. I mean, we're stood here next to a reconstruction of what it would have looked like. And yes, you've got this wonderful symmetry to a monastic site with the church that's doing all the spiritual work, and then the living quarters and the dormitory and the cloister as the sort of the heart of the building. But it would have been quite a nice place to live.
You would think so, because when we're here now, like, there's no fireplaces, so it's freezing.
Yeah.
So you'd always imagine a first instinct that it would be really difficult to live here. But like you can see outside, there's several fireplaces.
Exactly.
And they probably would have had braziers as well, lighting the room and keeping it warm. So they probably would have had it quite plush.
Yeah.
And they weren't that restrictive with the diet as well. There was all kinds of ways to get around not being able to eat meat and things. So you could just get yourself booked into the infirmary for a few days. And
to then, have a feast?
Yeah, just
really
feed yourself up a little bit.
It was quite... Well, they got around it in funny ways, because you couldn't eat meat... inside the refectory, so often they'd build extra dining rooms outside where they could eat meat.
Animals with cloven hooves and things like that, and I think there was something against ducks or birds or some like poultry. There was a rule for that, but they had ways of getting around it.
They did, and even in this space, that you've got a few things exhibited that have come up from the site themselves. But you've got the earthenware, the cups, the bottles, the things that would have been part of daily monastic life, but they're all quite high quality, aren't they?
They are, that's right. And I think what you have to bear in mind is, even if the life was fairly Spartan and you were up eight times a day praying for various, you know, had to be up in the night and that sort of thing, in comparison to what it was like outside,
exactly,
it was an awful lot better.
Exactly, because this is stone.
Yeah.
And again, I think the art historical importance of this building is extraordinary, because we are in a complete medieval space here. As you say, over at the chapter house, that is a complete 12th century space.
Yeah.
And it survives because it's stone. Whereas most people, of course, they're living in timber buildings, wattle and daub.
Yeah.
And life would have been, I think, probably less comfortable. Whereas the monks had a relatively all right time.
They found it quite easy.
Well, I think some of their activities were backbreaking and exhausting, weren't they? But
when you do the research into Birkenhead Priory, it was not what you might describe as a louche house.
No.
There, as far as I can see, that there are no examples of misbehaviour.
Was there anything in the dissolution documents about it? And
not particularly, no. Obviously, Wirral was a royal forest for a while, so there were a variety of spats between the Prior of Birkenhead and the forester over a long period, because, as you know, forest laws were actually pretty draconian.
Yeah.
If you wanted to build a fence or dig a ditch or something like that, then you were stopped doing it.
Yeah.
And so there are those incidents. But on the whole, the life here was fairly regulated and fairly good.
And it lasts for so long. That's the other thing I think we take for granted about the monasteries in England. Because they're halted so rapidly with Henry VIII, it seems like it's a short period of time, but there's monasteries bubbling away in this country for a millennium, and they give continuity, but they also give education, they give medical care, don't they? They work with the community.
Absolutely.
And the church would have served its function for the community as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So they're vibrant places that are important to understand.
That's right, yeah.
What's the thing you most enjoy about being involved with this place, Kate? What is it that excites you in the morning when you get here?
I like the architecture. Like you say, this place is beautiful. I love the arches. And just being able to stand in something that's so old and still so intact. Well, it's mostly intact anyway.
Yeah.
But just to try and picture like what it might have been, and you can walk around it and touch it. And it makes it tangible, which is what I like.
The idea that you're touching a stone that people have...
People have been walking for hundreds of years.
It is a magical place. What's the next part of the project here? What's going to be happening?
Well, over the last two or three years in particular, we've done a lot of work on the fabric of the building to make sure the medieval masonry is secure and safe for the future. And as part of that has been developing a group of volunteers that Kate's one of, who work on her beds and gardening around the site, who do volunteer guiding. The last part of the site that needs work doing on it is in fact that central building, the chapter house with the scriptorium, which of course still belongs to the Church of England. It doesn't belong to us. So we've tried one HLF bid that was knocked back, but we'll be working with the church to try and do that, because there's still a bit of work needs doing on the roof and those sort of things.
It is a piece of national history of great importance. We take for granted we go to a massive space like Durham Cathedral and stand inside something that's got Romanesque features. Mm. But there's something so intimate about that chapter house. The fact that it is a Norman building that has all of the major characteristics, all the major architectural features of a Romanesque building. And yet it's so tangible. It's, as you said, Kate, it's tactile. You can touch it. You can see it. Yeah. And you were saying to me about the plaster falling down and revealing those incredible ribbed vaults. Mm.
And say so that they up until the 50s, I think it was plastered, and then they took the plaster down and saw the stonework behind it and thought that it was a feature.
It's beautiful.
It is, yes, and it was pointed up in the 90s, so it's in very good condition now. And the site has an active life. Say that the Church of England still use the chapter house as a chapel. We have the volunteers. We have the Friends of HMS Conway, who have a museum and sort of chapel in the scriptorium above the chapter house. And the refectory above here we use for meetings, concerts for school groups, all of those things, because that was roofed over in the 90s to give us that extra space.
And I think, like so many of our great national buildings, partly because of Henry VIII ripping down a lot of the monasteries, they become living documents, and they are... there's almost like archaeological layers in these buildings. You could see their history played out. They've not remained intact and preserved like relics. They've constantly evolved and changed, haven't they?
That's right, yes. And that will carry on happening as long as people carry on using the site and finding different uses for it. And just enjoying it. And even though when the St. Mary's Parish Church was closed down because a lot of the local population had moved away. There were tenements and terraces that were knocked down in the 50s. Mm. But there is still a community here. There are still people who live within 200 yards of the building. And particularly because they built flats overlooking the river, because the best views of Liverpool are from Birkenhead, let's face it.
Well, I'm going to be taking some lovely views and photos to share with this podcast on Twitter and on Facebook. You guys are on social media, aren't you?
What's your Twitter? The Priory, it's at Birkenhead 1150.
At Birkenhead 1150.
Yeah, and there's Brother Tom the Monk as well. At Brother Tom Prior 1.
At Brother Tom Prior 1. Well, I have been so excited to be allowed in here. It gets closed up, doesn't it, to preserve it over the winter, and then it opens up again.
We reopen January the 31st, we reopen, and we're open to the public Wednesday, Thursday, Friday afternoons, and Saturday and Sunday all day. The times vary a bit between summer and winter, but that's the broad brush. And the website, which is www.thebirkenheadpriory.org, will give the information.
Great. For me, this is a really extraordinary place because you could go to the big monastic ruins like Revo, fountains. You can go to the big cathedrals that still have that fabric of monastic buildings in them. But there's something so intimate about Birkenhead Priory and so old. The fact that it is such an early Benedictine monastery that's still intact, I think it is an absolute historical nugget. And I'm so grateful that you guys let me come in
Thank
here today.
Coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's great.